You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Today, we're going to discuss a terrific new book about one of the most fascinating institutions in China. The institution is China Development Bank, and the book is China's Super Bank by Henry Sanderson and Mike Forsyth. Henry and Mike are both reporters with Bloomberg News in Beijing, where they've done some terrific reporting on the business interests of China's elite. And both of them were a part of the team that wrote a prize-winning series of articles on this topic. In China's Super Bank, Henry and Mike used their investigative journalism skills to lift the veil on China Development Bank. Despite the prominent role that the bank has played in financing China's economic boom and the international expansion of its companies, the bank is often absent from or relegated to a minor role in accounts of China Inc. But fortunately for those of us who are interested in the inner workings of Chinese state capitalism, Henry and Mike have written a highly readable book that charts China Development Bank's rise at home and abroad. Copies of the book are available for purchase in the back of the room. Please feel free to get up and buy one during the event. After the event, they'll be available for sale in our bookstore. I'm now going to yield the floor to the authors. They're each going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. However, I would like to note that we do need to end a little bit before 4 o'clock because there's another group that has this room booked for an event. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Mike Forsyth, and this is Henry Sanderson here. Thank you very much, Erica. It was really a lot of Erica's work that inspired us to write this book. She's heavily footnoted. She appears in many, many footnotes and references in our book, especially when we talk about the Oil for Loans program. And I think Erica early on realized the importance of China Development Bank to China's entire state capitalist model. And what we did is we also looked at the bank's role internally in China in driving the local government financing vehicle system in China that is responsible in many ways for some of the robust economic growth that we've seen in China, and also its work in other aspects internationally, funding some of the companies like Huawei, ZTE, and the solar and wind companies. Its finger is in every pie of China's state capitalist model. And our thesis in the book is that this bank, China Development Bank, is the most powerful bank in the world. And this is a very educated group here. You're probably scoffing at me right now, thinking, how can that be? You may think, well, we know Goldman Sachs is really the most powerful bank in the world, isn't it? After all, the political connections of Goldman Sachs we all know in Washington, they run true and deep. It seems like every former Treasury Secretary becomes somebody at Goldman or vice versa. Well, we submit that when it comes to political connections, it's really hard to beat China Development Bank. Until this week, the bank was led by a person whose political connections I think many people at Goldman would be quite jealous of. Chen Yuan, or we're from Beijing, so it's Chen Yuar, and that's how he likes to refer to himself among his friends. So Chen Yuan is a princeling among princelings in China. He's the son of Chen Yun, and Chen Yun was one of the architects of China's economy during the Mao era, and then during the Deng Xiaoping era in the 1980s, arguably the second most powerful person and one of the chief architects of the economic reform area early on. Is a very powerful man, and Chen Yuan is the son, and as we discovered reporting the book, I would say a very filial son, as we can actually maybe discuss in Q&A. These are political connections that are just really sterling. So we'll check off Goldman Sachs there. The World Bank, obviously a policy bank, bar none, except for China Development Bank, which has a loan book far larger than the world's banks now, and is a global bank. China Development Bank is all over the world, in Venezuela, in Africa, in Central Asia, Russia, and often the size of its projects are much, much larger than the World Bank's. So we'll cross off the World Bank, maybe. This is our thesis. Let's expand the definition of banks. Let's look at central banks. How about the Fed? Surely the Fed, led by Ben Bernanke, the savior of the world after the global financial crisis, right? I mean, after all, it was his philosophy, his deep understanding of the Great Depression that led to these insightful policies that helped the world recover from the global economic crisis. Well, as many of you know, China's economic growth did also slow a little bit. It did slow down. It did decelerate. There were some concerns, but it bounced back quite quickly, quite tremendously afterwards. We submit that one of the reasons, and we're not alone in this, is because of the system of local finance in China. Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania is often fond of saying there's a lot of shovel-ready projects out there in Pennsylvania, and that's how we're going to stimulate the economy. Well, China had $25 trillion, or renminbi, worth of shovel-ready projects, and many of those shovels actually hit the ground. This system, as we discovered in research, was actually invented in 1998 by China Development Bank, and spread because of China Development Bank across the country. And often it was the bank that was creating these local government financing vehicles in places from Yunnan to Chongqing to Tianjin. There's obviously a lot of problems with that system. We'll talk about that as well. So for all these reasons, we consider, and it's our thesis that forget about the other banks. This bank is probably the world's most powerful, most influential bank. And Henry is going to start getting into some of the details there.
Thank you, Mike. So during this research, obviously we found out policy banks are nothing new. Development banks are nothing new either. But the sheer scale of CDB, the fact that it's 100% state-owned, and that it's got its fingers in almost every single pie in China, including private equity, leasing, securities, underwriting, makes it quite a different animal. And this is just to show some of the figures. Mike talked about local governments. What we call LGFEs are these financing vehicles. CDB is, is the biggest lender to these guys, 26% of all LGFE loans. And we looked at solar, wind, and telecom, some of China's best companies, Huawei, ZTE. CDB has also lent billions of dollars. And Venezuela, we devoted a whole chapter to that because the scale is just off the charts. They've lent over $40 billion to Venezuela, a country with a huge history of default. And the China-Africa Development Fund, which is pretty much the only Chinese private equity fund investing in Africa. And despite their attempts to get foreign investors, actually CDB, most of the money comes from China Development Bank. So for all these reasons, we thought this bank was a lens to look at China's state capitalism, the model, especially in the light of the financial crisis, what kind of model this is and what we can learn from it. This is one thing I learned pretty quickly. Local governments in China are interesting topics. I went three times to this town Lodi in Hunan. We found this stadium just going through bond prospectuses. We went through almost every local government bond that was issued in China. And just in minutiae of these prospectuses, we found that one local government was trying to get money for a stadium. This is it. It was a colossal project, gymnasium, swimming center. And this land that the stadium's on was rural land and then became urban land. And a group of farmers were kicked off the land, moved into shanty towns to make way for this stadium. And this system that CDB invented is sort of a virtuous circle. Once the stadium's built, the property people told me that all the new apartments around the stadium have gone up in price. Therefore, the land's gone up in price. They paid the people who got kicked off the land relatively little, certainly not market prices. So this is one guy I interviewed a few times. He, his whole family history is as farmers, and for the first time, he's now joining the urban economy. He is living in a shanty town and building his own house. So this is really the whole system of how local governments raise money through selling land and, urbanization, which I would just say Chen Yuan, when he came to the bank, urbanization was his fundamental sort of view of how China's economy was going to develop. And he has really been pushing it a lot. As I said, we went through lots of prospectuses. And, going to these towns is great for anecdotes, but we also came up with a lot of data about local lending as well.
We'll just breeze through this really quickly. We won't spend too long. I just want to give you kind of an idea of there's a lot of misconceptions about China. People say, well, China's just not a transparent place. It's really hard to get any data there. True. China's also a very transparent place, and in some cases you can get an incredible amount of data if you know where to look. That's also true. And so one of the places we looked is in bond prospectus. This is just an example. This is the most indebted local government financing vehicle in China. It's in Tianjin. It's in the Tianjin-Binhai areas where it does most of its work. If you saw 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, I think Leslie Stahl went there with Ann Stevenson Young, and they went to the same place we went. This is this is just an idea of all the debt that that has been racked up. And you see that the top column is China Development Bank. It's the biggest lender. The line of credit it's given is 74 billion renminbi, so over $10 billion to this one local government financing vehicle. And keep in mind, there's well over 6,000 of these entities in China. This is the largest. You don't get this kind of data unless they sell a bond. When a local government financing vehicle sells a bond, the magic of disclosure happens. Maybe not the best disclosure, maybe not the most accurate information, but at least it's information. And all the other banks, almost all of them, it's the A list of Chinese banks, and some B and C listers down there, and some trust companies as well, are lenders to the local government financing vehicle. We kind of liken it to the Pied Piper. If you go through enough of these yourselves, and we don't have research assistants, we do this all ourselves. But you have to do that, or else you don't see the patterns, right? You have to do it. You can't let somebody else do it for you. You see throughout these prospectuses the fact that China Development Bank, they all thank China Development Bank, and in many cases it's CDB itself that went in, and that's the case in Tianjin, to set up this whole system of local finance. They're the ones who created it. And when they come in, it's like the Pied Piper. They lead everybody else in as well. And this is the result, $317 billion of lines of credit. This is what's left. This is they've spent most of it. They've got some of it left. This is a little backward looking. It's in 2011. We only get new information when they sell a new bond. But anyway, I've probably talked a little bit too much about that. This is what they're building with it. If you saw Leslie Stahl, I think it was Leslie Stahl, you'll see she went there as well. We went there 2 years ago. This is Eastern Tianjin. This used to be the city of Tanggu. If you're into Chinese history, or the Qing forts, the Dagu forts were over here. This is Tanggu. This is where the troops came up, the British and French troops in 1860 on their way to Beijing to destroy the Summer Palace. And this is Manhattan, as you can easily see. East River, Hoboken is over there. Hoboken is SOEville, basically. Now, it's all these buildings over in Hoboken are built by one SOE after another. They all appeared to be empty when I was there, and certainly when 60 Minutes was there years later. And I asked a woman who was showing us around there, well, are there any private companies doing anything there? She pointed to a hotel. What does CDB have to do with this? Again, they created this entire structure that created this ability to finance something like this. Well, this is a financial center, right? This is, in fact, Rockefeller Foundation, Lincoln Center, they're all cooperating to make this into a Manhattan. One would think that you're going to get some big financial anchor tenants in here to buttress this, you know, maybe a Goldman Sachs, or at least an ICBC, one of those big Chinese commercial banks. Let me roll off this name for you. You'll be impressed. Anchor tenant, Tianjin Rural Commercial Bank. A household name. We all grew up with it, right? One of the problems of being a journalist in China is obviously we're wrong a lot. We've all written stories about how we see all these empty buildings. We say, this is a disaster. This is going to collapse. And then the buildings fill up with tenants. This is a humbling thing about China. I've written that story about Beijing office space. I was wrong. People in 1996 wrote that about Pudong in Shanghai. It's going to be a disaster. It's not going to work. They were wrong. People like me were writing about the railway, saying they're spending all this money. They're not going to possibly be able to make this a success. We went on the train to Shanghai the other day. It was packed with people. It was magnificent. I was on the Amtrak yesterday coming from New York, and I was quite embarrassed, frankly, to be an American. So maybe it'll work out. Rockefeller Center. I'll hand it over to you now, Henry. You want to keep talking? We're gonna kind of shift away from the domestic part and go to more of the international part, which I think a lot of people are interested in.
So just as part of this book, we spent a long time sort of researching Chen Yuan, the person, a lot of stuff that he wrote before he took over the bank and then the early days of the bank. And one of the things that he wanted when he first joined the bank was two things, really. One was he would serve the government, the strategic aims of the government. And number two was they wouldn't make a loss. They wouldn't have huge amount of losses. So they'd make a profit and also serve the government. And when China joined the WTO, they're facing a lot of competition. And anyway, after that, they wanted their companies to go overseas to become global companies. And this go global policy was something that China Development Bank was one of the first banks to really back this policy. And it's now the Chinese bank with the largest amount of foreign loans, overseas loans, some 250 billion foreign currency loans. So we looked at Africa and Venezuela, but they also, we didn't get time to look too much. Central Asia, Eastern Europe, they just did a deal for a power station in Bosnia. They really are lending almost everywhere you can think of. And the Africa chapter, I went to Ethiopia, and we interviewed the head of the China Africa Development Fund in Beijing. And this fund is very interesting in that it's notionally a private equity fund. And when we went to interview the head of the fund, we brought with us a top Bloomberg editor. One of his first questions was, "Are you making any money?" And the guy said, "No, we're not actually." And the Bloomberg editor said, "Well, what's the proposition for investors? You know, what's the attraction?" And the head of the fund said, "Oh, well, it's a long term. We think much more long term than you guys." And actually, he admitted they found it much more difficult in Africa than they first thought. Yeah, so Ethiopia was interesting to see these difficulties firsthand, actually, that I could see. And the theory behind this, which is a theory that Justin Lin, who is at the World Bank, now back in Beidar, I actually saw him at the Boal Forum, and he said the same thing. He said African countries have a unique chance to develop manufacturing. As labor costs rise in China, some of these companies can shift to Africa where there's great raw materials. And everyone in Ethiopia told me how great the leather is. So this is the idea behind this. And the CADF, the China Africa Fund, has invested in a leather factory there and also co-investing in a shoe factory. So this is one of the factories I went to in the Eastern Industry Zone. I'm sure you've been there. You can see it's a very Chinese style factory. These banners you'll see most places in China. Every morning they gather outside to sing Chinese songs. And one end of the factory were boxes of these shoes destined for Europe and the US. And the motivation, the morale there seemed high. And the idea behind this seems very good until I actually just talking to more people. There were so many problems that they talked about. If you think about Ethiopia as landlocked, the road... Djibouti, I think, is the nearest port, and not very good infrastructure to get stuff out of the country. And interestingly, another project, a glass factory that the fund had invested in, wasn't working when I was there. It stopped production because they found exporting glass in Africa wasn't as easy as they thought. This is the raw leather factory on the outskirts of Addis Ababa. And one thing the Chinese complained to me a lot about was... some of the government policies weren't perhaps as attractive as they would be in China, where local governments move heaven and earth to attract foreign investment. They complained that there were limits on Chinese staff, the number of Chinese managers they could bring in. Also limits, difficulties importing raw materials they needed. And also quite strict labor laws they talked about. They couldn't work the staff as hard as they wanted to. And another example we looked at was Ghana, just mainly because... we found during this book there was very little transparency from the bank about its international loans. And Ghana was one case where there was a lot of transparency because, it's a democracy. And the vice president, prime minister, who's now prime minister, came out to Beijing and gave a press conference after having lunch with Chen Yuan and was willing to answer lots of things about this big loan the bank has agreed to extend to Ghana, $3 billion, which is the largest loan in the country's history. And it's really caused a lot of debate in Ghana because, as you can see from this graph, Ghana got into quite a bit of debt before and went through a series of debt forgiveness and debt restructurings. before China came along, and at the same time, oil was discovered offshore. So we really think this loan is poses a lot of interesting questions about what China can do different from the past. Oil, obviously, in Africa hasn't been that successful in Nigeria and Angola. So their debt levels have gone back up. And amazingly, the contract for this loan stipulates 60% has to go to Chinese companies, which is an incredible amount of money. And this is all sorts of projects, including projects like a gas project by Sinopec, so they can sell the gas from the oil fields. And in this way, the way the Chinese see it is these projects will help the country pay back its loan. And Venezuela is also a similar oil for loan structure.
We looked at Venezuela in particular just because of the sheer size of the lending that's gone on there. And Erica has done, you know, did all the pioneering research on this and is far more knowledgeable than us. So I'll be very careful what I say. So you recognize the person on the left, the late president of the country, Hugo Chavez, and then the man on the right is Chen Yuan, who is in the process of leaving CDB. As far as we know, his replacement has been named, I think, the Bank of Communications chairman is on his way there, Hu Haibang. So there is a lot of transition there. A very close relationship, over 4 years, $40 billion in loans made by CDB to Venezuela. Most of that's in dollars, but about 70 billion renminbi, I think, in renminbi loans, so a little over $10 billion of that in renminbi loans. This is for the Oil for Loans program, which, again, I think in Q&A maybe Erica can talk a little bit more about. But the idea being is there's a way to secure oil deliveries to China. And this goes around the world. It's in Russia. It's in countries in Africa, in Central Asia as well, and involves gas. Now, one thing I have to say is this was a very difficult book to report, and Erica had the same, I think, encountered some of the similar problems actually talking to people at CDB. We have one advantage in that we're reporters. We often go to events in Beijing, and if there was a CDB person there, we would just kind of try to get them as they're leaving or maybe, you know, coming back from the restroom or something. And we did get a few people this way. Chen Yuan never did an interview with him. Some of the other higher officials in the bank, Gao Jian, never got a chance to. They were often very nice and polite to us, but declined to talk to us. This guy was different. He talked to us. I captured him 1 year going out from a restroom at the National People's Congress. And then the next year, trying to do it again, he finally relented and gave an interview. His name is Liu Kegu. He's retired now, but he was a vice governor of the bank, and he was really the point man for CDB in Latin America. Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, called him his brother. He would bring, you know, groups of officials, Chinese officials, CDB officials, over to Venezuela to meet with all the ministers there. An amazing guy. Now, one of the things we really wanted to focus on in the book is the political risk involved. He didn't want to talk about politics with us, although he had a lot of nice things to say about Chavez. And we kept asking, well, what about the political risk to these loans in Venezuela? Now, I mean, we know that they're being paid back through oil shipments. We know that. But, you know, what if there's a political instability in the country? You know, what's going to happen? Well, this is his philosophy. Oil is very simple to drill. You drill a hole, you put in a pipe, and it comes out, and then you ship it. So Venezuela's debt serviceability is very strong. You laugh. So far, it's working. So far, so good. But as we all know, there's been a lot of political turmoil and instability in Venezuela as of late. The country has two centuries of defaulting and disappointing and heartbreaks for international investors. So the question is, and the currency was devalued in February. It certainly is no darling of rating agencies. The question for the bank is it exposing itself to risk, and is it appropriately shielding itself from the risk in Venezuela? One thing we did look at that I think has been done by other scholars, I think Kevin Gallagher as well, but I think we kind of advanced it a little bit, is taking a look at the whole system of lending to Venezuela. So look beyond the oil for loans and what kind of contracts are Chinese companies winning in Venezuela. So there is a very common expression in China, you know, that you hear ad nauseum. This is a win-win situation, shuangying. But in this case, it's true. China wins twice. So China gets oil, or at least Chinese state oil companies take delivery of oil, and then Chinese SOEs, for the most part, which are major CDB clients, get contracts. And so we tallied up $11.6 billion in contracts that Chinese firms won. And there are some stipulations as well on, mandatory or compelling the Venezuelans to buy Chinese products or get Chinese services, get contracts for Chinese companies. So that's just what we counted up. There's probably a lot more out there. But the fact is that you can find this material. It is, Chinese state-owned enterprises are corporatized. That means that they issue annual reports. These are actually public documents. You can find them. If they sell a bond, there's even more disclosure. So just an example. So CITIC, the granddaddy of all SOEs, is in Venezuela doing quite a few projects there. One of the projects they're doing, and you can just get the information in Chinese, they're building 20,000 housing units, and it's won the praise of Hugo Chavez as well. So, you keep looking through these documents, and you can actually start piecing together the amount of Chinese contracts. It's really just a keyword search on these documents, and so it wouldn't be a PowerPoint presentation without one of these fancy graphics here. But all it just illustrates is the fact that Chinese SOEs are getting contracts, and China is getting oil. And one of the things we discovered, and this is something Erica was really investigating in her piece that she wrote for Brookings, is is the oil really getting to China? And we were really lucky before publication last year when Chen Yar discovered we were really going to write this book and really going to publish it. He did send a couple of emissaries to us. And in the course of a conversation, which was a fascinating one, they did admit that, yes, indeed, a lot of the oil actually never makes it to China. Because, really, you're going to send it all across the Pacific Ocean? I mean, that's really expensive. You burn half the oil getting there. So it's also very heavy oil. Most refineries to take care of this, to refine this kind of oil are in the United States. And so why ship it all the way over to China? There's a huge disparity in Venezuelan export figures to China and Chinese import figures of Venezuelan oil. They said, quite frankly, yes, it's being sold elsewhere. It's not going to China. So that was, I thought, something we could contribute to the general scholarship. It's all a system, if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So we wanted one company to sort of sum up what this bank is about and how it's different from Western banks. And this company, Cherry Auto, sort of did that for us. In a sense, this company exhibits all the sort of support the CDB can give a Chinese company. Of course, their products have actually got to be good, but look at this company. It's a product of a local government ownership in China, and LGFE owns stakes in this company. It's also first received loans and lines of credit from CDB, not a small amount either. And then it's moved into Africa with the help of China Africa Development Fund. And also it's moved into Venezuela. Chavez actually was pretty keen on Cherry, had his own nicknames for these cars. So you can see that this one company is expanded in areas where the bank can help. And we also looked at Huawei and ZTE. This is one quote that stuck out at us from the U.S. Exim Bank, which, of course, is a complete minnow compared to CDB. He said the one thing that kept him up at night was China Development Bank. Why did he say this? Well, if you look at the figures, lines of credit and loans to ZTE and Huawei have been pretty huge. And this graph actually comes from a book written for CDB about case studies by the bank. And Chen Yuan met the head of Huawei, I think it was 2004, 2005. They signed the first line of credit. And then after that, you can see their overseas sales just shot up pretty dramatically. So I think you can make the case that this line of credit had a pretty big impact on this company's success. We worked with some of our overseas bureaus to interview some of these companies in the developing world. And, they told us that these lines of credit did make a big difference, and they were just too attractive to resist. Chen Yuan also, interestingly, hasn't been shy about saying that this bank is the cause or one of the reasons for these companies' success. This is an essay he wrote in China Reform magazine. Just to say, this bank, he says it's a principal source of finance for overseas investments. So this really builds a case that we're trying to make that this bank is the power behind China's overseas investment. I'll just talk briefly about solar. It was interestingly, after the financial crisis, both simultaneously China and the U.S. wanted a renewable energy industry and wanted the jobs that would come from that industry. And in 2010, CDB lent almost every single company in China renewable energy, wind and solar. And we're lucky to have this Bloomberg New Energy Finance that tracks these figures, and they get a total of 68.8 billion lines of credit since 2010. If you compare the Solyndra guarantee in the U.S., which is just a couple of million dollars. So it's really on a different scale. This one graph we use just to sum up how China's financial system works. This really says a lot about how little sense of risk there is in China's financial system. You can see that this top graph is a bond of a German solar company, SolarWorld. So you can see in late 2011, people started getting worried about this industry. People started dumping their bond. The yield went right up to over 40%. At the same time, you can see these Chinese companies who sold bonds in China, the yield barely budges at all. So that means these Chinese companies effectively could borrow again at this rate. They also are getting this money from the bond market. So this sums up how little sense of risk there is in China's system. It's a closed system. The bond market in China doesn't suffer from crises of confidence that other markets have. It doesn't have hedge funds dumping debt the whole time. Again, Mike was saying how much detail you can find in these prospectuses. We found a lot. You can find loans for Yingli, $1.34 billion. It's all there. It's all disclosed. It's not a secret. So do you want to say more?
I would say in this one, if you're looking at Yingli, so Yingli Solar is one of the largest solar companies in China. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Its stock price has been hammered in the last couple of years, just like the international ones. And yet it can still borrow at that low rate, and its bond prices aren't fluctuating. This is actually not the listed arm, but this is the group. This is the Chinese company that owns the listed company in New York. And so you can just see how the lending is documented year after year. This is in U.S. dollars, in units of hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's just a lot of information out there that, some people may not think is available. It is. It's just you just have to look through all these documents. Another bond prospectus, and again, there's China Development Bank right there. One thing you may be thinking is we're talking about lines of credit. Well, are they all used up? You can have a line of credit, but if you don't use it, is that really lending? In this case, this is CDB. You say there's nothing left. It's been all used. Most of the other banks that are on here, there's still some that hasn't been used up yet. But this 8-year loan and the maturity on the CDB loan is much longer than the lending on the CDB money. Bank lending is much longer. So this is information about bank lending that's in a bond prospectus. So it's not just bond information you find in there. It's actually the lending information. And sometimes these prospectuses are incredibly detailed and list, for very specific loans on very specific dates, the exact maturities, the interest rate. So you can get a lot of information about bank lending that China's biggest banks are making, not just CDB, to Chinese companies and to local government financing vehicles, whatever, in these prospectuses. So I think it's a lot of interesting information. I think we'll sum things up here. Do you want to wrap it up?
Sure. A lot of people asked us in our talks in China, have Chinese people got value for their money? And this is kind of a critical question. We didn't talk too much about how CDB gets its money, but it sells, almost every week it's selling maybe 20 trillions of yuan in bonds or billions of yuan in bonds. Which commercial banks buy. Commercial banks own 80% of these bonds. And essentially this money comes from Chinese depositors in the end of the day. So you've really got to ask, what's CDB done for this money that it's getting at relatively cheap costs? We came to the conclusion that, the LGFE model has helped promote GDP in China. It's also created a lot of useful infrastructure. Oil for loans has helped secure oil for China. And CDB has also promoted these great companies, Huawei and ZTE. On the minus side, interestingly, a lot of risk factors we pointed out have actually come to the fore since we published this book, such as Venezuela, The solar companies, LDK just defaulted the other day. It's a Chinese solar company, and SunTech also defaulted. So you, for the renewable energy, you've got to ask, maybe the model is too good, too successful for its own good. And also trade partners, you know, if there's backlash to a lot of this lending, is that actually a really good model if it creates tension with trade partners? That's something also to look into. And local government debt, I'm amazed, still go to conferences in China, still such a hot topic, local government debt. It hasn't gone away. People are still really worried about what's going to happen with this debt. I was at the Boao Forum, and a previous finance minister said, oh, yeah, I estimate local government debt is now 20 trillion yuan, and its official estimate is 10.7 trillion yuan. So, you know, the worrying thing is they don't know how much is out there, and they seem to be thinking an extra trillion here and there is no big deal. That is a huge problem for this bank, being the biggest lender to local governments. So all these risk factors make this book a very hot topic. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Henry and Mike, for a great presentation. Before I open up the floor to questions, I have one I'd like to ask myself, and this is going to require peering into your crystal balls. As you mentioned in your book, you can't really understand China Development Bank without understanding Chen Yuan, because his fingerprints are all over the institution, and he really almost single-handedly made the bank what it is today. As you mentioned in the beginning of your talk, he's stepping down reportedly to spearhead China's efforts to work on the BRICS Development Bank. And so my question is, what impact is Chen Yuan's departure from CDB likely to have on the bank and its operations?
Yeah, I'll just say, in the book, we did find that this institution is a real child of Chen Yuan. At the beginning, when he took over, had 40% non-performing loans. I think his political clout allowed the bank to reduce those non-performing loans and become a more professional institution. But because he's been there so long, I feel like the challenge for this bank is to have a sustainable culture, you know, integrity beyond him. And talking to a lot of international lawyers that we did in Beijing who deal with the bank the whole time, they always complained about, oh, we had to wait for Chen Yuan to sign off on a document. Mm-hmm. So it's still pretty hierarchical under him. And I think the challenge is Hu Huaibang, right? He doesn't have the political connections that Chen Yuan has. But does the bank have a self-sustaining culture of professionalism to continue? I think that's a big question.
Yeah. And maybe Mr. Hu does, and we just don't know. But he certainly doesn't have the pedigree of Chen Yuan. That we know for sure. And I think one metric you can look at whether that political influence survives or whether the impact of his departure is so CDB's. It exists because it doesn't have depositors. You can't put your money really in the CDB bank unless you're an oil company. But if a depositor doesn't put money in the CDB, they buy bonds. As Henry said, they're bond financed, and so those bonds are basically they have a zero risk weighting. In other words, banks don't have to set aside capital when they buy these bonds. They're basically sovereign debt. And there has been a push for years to change that. And every year, it seems CDB gets a waiver. It's extended another year, because the bank technically is a commercial bank. I think more in name only, you know, a commercial bank. It's a policy bank. But one of the hallmarks of it being a commercial bank is to lose that risk, there's zero risk weighting. If it does that, that means CDB is going to have to pay more to borrow money. And that means whatever profit margin it has is going to be squeezed even further. And since it's such a small profit margin, it's conceivable that that's going to become a loss now, and it'll be a money-losing bank. So that's something to look for. If it's able to extend that ad infinitum, you know, on and on and on, well, maybe Chen's departure, you know, isn't as big of an impact as one would think. But it's certainly, you know, he is the bank.
Thank you. I'm now going to open up the floor. I mean, if you could identify yourself by name and institution before answering your question, that would be great. I'll start up here with Deborah.
Hi, I'm Deborah Brodigam from Johns Hopkins University SAIS.
Our neighbor here, Brookings. Great book, you guys. I recommend it highly to everybody. You did a wonderful job. A few quick points. It really seems as though the CDB is one of its roles is as an export credit agency. And as an export credit agencies always finance their own companies to do things and their own companies to provide services. So why should this be very controversial if, you know, 60, 70%, that's actually quite good. You know, if you get to use 40 or 30% of the loan for something else. And the second point on, you mentioned that you have some tension, I think, in your model, which is that these loans or these lines of credit are a way to secure oil deliveries to China. That's one thing you said. And then you also pointed out later on that the oil doesn't necessarily go to China. So I'm seeing in Africa that these loans are secured by cocoa beans, sesame seeds, and it's not, you know, a desperate search for these things. So is it more the security or is it more the, I mean, is it more the security for the loan or is it more the resource security that's operating here? Quick point on loans versus lines of credit. We're seeing lots of lines of credit, I would say. To call them loans, most of the ones I'm seeing, they have to actually become a loan in order to become a debt. And so when they're just out there as a framework agreement, it's not really a loan. It's a potential loan. So there's a difference there between what the debt situation is for these countries. And then finally, is CDB the most powerful bank? What is power? And what about influence? And I would say the World Bank still has a lot of influence, and they can leverage a lot of other money through their ideas. I don't see CDB coming out there with ideas. We saw one example in Venezuela of some policy advice coming in. But other than that, where are the ideas? Where is the influence coming? Or is it just raw money?
I think certainly raw money, just to answer the last question, is one of the hallmarks of CDB, you know, the scale that it can bring to all sorts of projects from, you know, Venezuela to Russia to wherever is something that you don't see replicated in any other countries. And certainly, you know, from the interviews we did, it does look like, you know, and I think we were careful that we need to differentiate between lines of credit and lending, and I think we tried to do that there. And in fact, those documents do that as well. It's interesting to note, though, that ZTE looks like they've already gone through their initial $15 billion line of credit. Now they've got another $20 billion line of credit. And so it looks like they are being used up, and certainly in local government areas. And in the one case, the CDB one was the one they used up. So those loans, they are making those loans. I know there's a lot of questions there, Deborah. But
yeah, I'll just say about ideas and influence. You know, looking at the BRICS Bank, I think Chen Yuan was really pushing for that pretty strongly. And I think if you want to talk about international influence, maybe that's one way that they've tried to promote their model right through the BRICS Bank. And if these reports are true that he's going to head the BRICS Bank, then I think you could see his influence behind it pretty strongly. On other ways, I mean, just doing this book, you know, Brazilian Development Bank was very interested in it. I think they have had impact on other development banks in the sense that they've looked at this model quite closely. So that also, I think, had an impact. On the export credit agency, again, I agree with Mike. It's more to do with the size and also total state ownership. In a one-party system with Leninist, you know, structure.
Right.
And Chen Yuan's pedigree is...
right.
You know, I'm not sure how many other export credit agencies operate on that political model.
Yeah. And it would be very interesting to actually look at... we did look at statistics from Ecuador, Brazil. You saw the same pattern. There was a discrepancy of the Ecuadorian oil export figures and the Chinese import figures from Ecuador. You know, we didn't find any documentation that said that that oil was actually being sold elsewhere. But you know, it is also geographically far away from China. It would be very interesting to look like in Africa for some of the other commodities to see if that pattern also holds. Again, you have to put a lot of faith in statistics, and you know, and obviously in China, there's lies, there's damn lies, there's statistics, then there's Chinese statistics. So I don't know. you know, how reliable they are, but there certainly is a discrepancy.
Yeah. So just to follow on the loan, was it for oil or was that just collateral? Yeah. I think since Chavez has died, a lot of like Chinese scholars who study this, they keep saying as long as they export oil, there's no problem. So I do think collateral is a big part of it, especially if the oil is not going to China. Yeah. But then it's more, the agreement is more just a right to access this supply, not necessarily the right to immediately buy it at a certain price.
And I don't know if Erica, if that's, what did you find though also in your research about that?
I mean, I guess I would say that it's not just about oil. I mean, I think you can't completely dismiss that in terms of the motivations. But I guess when it comes to Venezuela, my view is actually is that the biggest winners are the Chinese construction companies that are getting business there. And in terms of the gap, PDVSA, the Venezuelan oil company, which is the one that's delivering the oil to China Oil, in some of their annual financial publications, they do have tables that show, one, sort of how much oil they've been delivering to China Oil on an annual basis to secure these loans. And they also have another table that shows how much they export to China. And there is a bit of a gap. So not everything's going to China, as Mike said. And China Oil, the company that delivers, actually, you know, a trader of oil in the Americas. So I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not surprised to see that there is that gap, because some of that probably is being sold locally. The gentleman here in the tan jacket.
I'm Barry Wood. I write for MoneyWeb in Johannesburg and RTHK in Hong Kong. I was in Durban for the BRICS summit, where President Xi was very much the star, and his visits to Tanzania and Congo, as well as South Africa. What do you think China has in mind for the BRICS bank? They can't simply foist a Chinese model on Brazilians and Russians and Indians, I wouldn't think. And do you think some of the tensions about working out the ownership structure is the reason that the formulation of the BRICS Bank has been delayed?
All yours.
Tricky question. I do agree. It seems in my mind that these countries don't have actually a lot in common beyond high growth that's actually slowing now. So I think there will be a lot of disagreement in how to arrange a BRICS bank. And given that CDB is not that transparent, it hasn't been that transparent, is that the kind of model that they want? That's a big question. I think we're still to see the details, but I, again, was disappointed there was so little details out of the BRICS summit. And that must mean they're having some problems, I think.
But having Chen Yuan, you know, if he really does have a role and if he does take the chairmanship, is a signal that, you know, if you've got that kind of commitment from China, you know, maybe China, you know, we don't know for sure, but maybe China will be committed to this bank and wanted to make it a success. And obviously China can bring a lot of money to the table. So, you know, when I saw that Chen Yuan looked like he might be heading it, and again, we haven't confirmed that independently. I think we've confirmed with CDB that indeed he's leaving and the new guy's coming in. But the BRICS part is, I haven't been looking in the last day or so, though I don't know what's going on. But, you know, that given his influence, I think it's something, you know, notable that, you know, maybe they're taking this seriously. Again, that's just my opinion. I don't know. I don't have any fact to really back that up, though. Yeah.
It had been said, for example, that the headquarters would be in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. But that, too, now seems to be open to discussion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would just say, just a week before the BRICS summit, Foreign Ministry had a press briefing I went to, and they gave very little details about the bank, almost nothing. So,
not that we get any details from Foreign Ministry, but yeah.
Nick?
Nick Larry Peterson. I was with Chen Yuan on Wednesday last week, and he told me he'd be stepping down soon, so I don't think there's any doubt about that at all, although I don't think there's been any official announcement. My question is more on the financing. You mentioned that this bank is funded entirely by issuing bonds to other financial institutions rather than taking deposits from either corporate or corporate customers or households. Can you say something about, you know, since you've examined all these bond prospectuses, how would you characterize the yields that they have to pay to get other financial institutions to hold their bonds? And how is this reflected in their lending costs? Like, for example, if you take the vendor lending that Huawei has available for its end users or the purchasers of its telecom switching equipment or whatever it is they're selling, Does it? What can you? How would you characterize it, or how, what can you tell us about it?
So I just say, looking at CDB's own bonds, they're always, most often, a little more higher yield than treasuries, but lower yield than, you know, private companies, obviously, and the smaller banks in China. But interestingly, they're not so close to treasuries that it's the same as the government borrowing. So there is some difference, and it does actually fluctuate because CDB bonds are the best traded bonds in China. So there is actually a lot of liquidity, so people trade them a lot. So there is actually more fluctuation than in these LGFE bonds or private companies. I think it's reflected in the lending. Well, domestically, CDB, if you look at these prospectuses, they often lend at similar rates to commercial banks, maybe the PBOC rate plus a small margin. But I think the thing is maturity of the loans are much longer and the amount of the loans is much larger. Mm-hmm. And then overseas, you know, there have been reports that CDB can use the foreign exchange reserves to lend in dollars. If that's the case, then they have a huge advantage in terms of getting dollars
right.
to lend overseas. So I think overseas, their loans are based on LIBOR. I don't think the rate is ridiculously cheap, not that we found, but it's much longer maturity. And just the sheer amount of money, I think, is mm-hmm. different.
And so, you know, some of the so they're paying, you know, a little bit more than what a treasury bond would be yielding or in China. Some of the bond prospectuses you dig up, you know, again, they have details on CDB bank lending. And so you see, for a typical one, you know, like Ningbo, the construction company, the local government financing vehicle in Ningbo would borrow at 7%. Sometimes you see 8%. So there is a spread there. I mean, certainly they are, you know, they aren't giving, in many cases, you know, a completely bargain basement rate, you know, to their local government clients. That's still a pretty good rate, you know, for these banks, considering how difficult it is if you're a private company to borrow any money. And so, yeah, but we can actually, you know, dig up some more, you know, specific, you know, examples around the country, Nick, if you'd like, and to see what kind of rate CDB is making on its loans to these.
But companies. It makes a currency loss every year because it's overseas loans. It converts RMB to lend in dollars, so it does make a loss on that.
Yeah. Although it does have some overseas bonds, too, it does borrow.
Okay, in the back.
Thank you. My name is Aydin. I'm from George Washington University. You mentioned Eastern Europe and actually like that China Development Bank lent to Eastern Europe and Bosnia. So I'm interested about your thoughts and is that going to have some kind of implications or some kind of influence on European Union, and what's your thought about that? Thank you.
Yeah, we didn't focus a lot on Europe. We focused mostly on the developing countries. You know, I know there's been difficulties with some Chinese lending, like for that highway project in Poland. You know, and there is a conflict in many cases in projects around the world on the Chinese standards and best practices and sometimes best practices in EU nations. So there's a pretty steep learning curve there.
Yeah, I would say, so the Eastern Bosnia case, you know, I was talking to a lawyer who worked on that case. And one problem they're finding in Europe is that the Chinese company doing the construction is often, to the European client, unproven and untested. And often they don't want to take the risk of that company doing the project. And CDB also doesn't necessarily want to take the risk. So while the finance might be there, the Chinese companies often have problems convincing the client they can do the job. But it is having an impact on the EU. You know, the British are really trying to get Chinese investment right now. And CDB is one of the top places to go lobby. And, you know, Guangdong Nuclear might do a deal in the UK. I'm sure CDB will be involved. But again, convincing the UK public that Guangdong Nuclear is going to be a safe investment is not easy.
Up here.
Thank you very much. I'm Wang Qi with Chinese Embassy. And I have two comments and one question. The first is that from economic perspective, we might need to tell the difference between the the policy bank and the commercial bank. CDB is a policy bank based on commercial cooperation. And so I think the CDB need to implement some government objective. And actually, I think the policy bank is common around the world. Even here, U.S. has an import-export bank, and even President Obama suggests to set up so-called National Infrastructure Bank. Mm-hmm. So I think that if we take into the policy bank take policy bank sector factor into account, maybe it's understandable to understand. Maybe it's more easy to understand the operation of CDB. Secondly, is about China's investment in Africa. I think China's investment in Africa is to pursue win-win. China's president just visited Africa. In Tanzania, he paid a tribute to a cemetery where 69 Chinese engineers, workers, were buried there. They sacrificed their life in building Tanzania-Zambia Railway in 1970s, which was one of the most prominent China's aid project in Africa. So China's investment, China has long-lasting friendship with African countries. Most African countries welcome China's investment. Just as the picture in a slide that China helped African countries to build their own manufacturing system, to invest a lot in infrastructure, to help them to train local staff. And according to our study, among all the China's concessional loans to Africa, most of them go to infrastructure projects. Only about less than 10% go to energy sector. My question is that CDB should have some responsibility to implement so-called a policy project. My question is that have you ever evaluated the cost of such policy projects for the bank? If taking into these factors, maybe the CDB is not so powerful.
You mean Thank the you. Cost? How do you mean?
Cost of policy bank, cost of implement government-oriented projects.
Mm-hmm.
At the local level, infrastructure, urbanization.
Right. I mean, all we can really look at is their lending that they do. The annual reports of CDB consistently do show a small profit for the bank. That's their annual report. Clearly these are massive projects. And I would say that we completely agree with you that, yes, it's a policy bank, but it tries to act at least on commercial principles, which is what something that I think Chen Yuan has contributed to the thinking on policy bank and around the world, is his attitude towards risk management in projects. And he did say no to the NDRC, when he took over the bank after 1998. He did nix some projects. He did say no, and so he was able to improve the performance of the bank. But it is still a policy bank. It's still there to carry out the policies of the government, even though it's also a commercial bank, although in name maybe more than in reality. But on the cost...
Yeah, we just say there probably are some costs, but the bank is trying to make it up. It's expanding into private equity. It has a very expensive office in Hong Kong, CDB Capital. It's the biggest bond underwriter in China through CDB Securities. It's moved into all these different areas where it can actually make money. And you've got to question what it's doing in private equity, for instance. What's it doing in Hong Kong? The head of the Hong Kong branch got removed recently because of a certain Ping An deal. There's a big risk of policy drift for this bank. It's moving into so many areas. And I think one of those reasons is to make money, right? So that it can bear the burden of some of these other policy projects.
Thanks. I'm Don Clark, George Washington University. My question is, how far is it really true that they're operating according to commercial principles? I mean, this is something right, you say a lot, but then when I look at the details of what you say, that doesn't really add up. For example, first of all, their source of funds is not the market rate for capital, right? They're getting them, you know, at a very, very low cost. And yet, even then, they're barely making a profit. They're going around the world making loans where no other commercial bank, you know, that's responsible to its shareholders and its domestic regulators will dare to tread. Mm-hmm. So either they have discovered, you know, a different way of assessing commercial risk that no one else in the world has discovered, or they're not operating according to commercial principles. I mean, I guess I think it's got to be one or the other, doesn't it?
I think it's a different way of risk. And interestingly, ICBC did go into Venezuela after CDB had sort of laid the path. They also did a deal in Venezuela. So I get the sense they have a different way of measuring risk.
But is that an accurate way? Mm-hmm. You know?
I don't know, but they told us, like, oh, yeah, we don't use Western credit rating agencies. You know, they have their own way of...
Would you guys point out in your article... rates the bonds of Lodi, I believe, higher than it as a better risk than United States Treasuries, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, the worst bond in China, the filthiest, ugliest local government financing vehicle bond in China is not in Lodi, but is in Heilongjiang province. It's in this county, Yichun County. And that bond is rated above U.S. Treasuries by Dagong. And as we pointed out in that graph, the risk pricing doesn't seem to be reflective of the actual risks, like in the market. You know, so Yingli stock, you know, which is traded in New York, like all the other solar stocks, just took a beating. You know, because it started to go into a loss. It was losing money. There was overcapacity, thanks to them, in the industry. And so when the company is exposed to global markets, you see. It behaves in the same way. It's you know, the stock price goes down, but internally in China nothing happens. You know, it's you don't even see an uptick in the yields of this bond. That's clearly, I'll say it here. That's a misallocation of capital. That's not risk price. You're not pricing the risk unless there's no risk of defaults at all, because the government's always going to bail it out. But that leads, as Nick would always say, to maybe a misallocation of capital. My favorite example again is in Ningbo. So the Ningbo local construction vehicle borrows at 7% a year. Down the road in Wenzhou, there's a private drug company, a pharmaceutical company. They want to expand, increase consumption in GDP, which is consistent with the five-year plan. They can also borrow at 7%, 7% a month. Their debt's not guaranteed. There hasn't been a default, as far as we know, on a local government financing vehicle yet. There's been some problems, like in Yunnan, but they seem to somehow get fixed. So if it's risk-free, if they're not going to default, this is what you get.
But just one last point on, do they run on commercial principles? I asked Xiao Gang, head of Bank of China, should they commercialize? And he said, yes, they should. And I think if commercial banks are sort of slightly annoyed by CDB's status, then I think that means they think CDB is making too much money or getting too good of a deal. So that's also quite interesting.
Up here.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. It's been extremely interesting. My question was, again, surprise, surprise, on the topic of bonds. Amazingly enough. This is a somewhat pedantic question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So it's interesting that the way CDB finances itself is issuing domestic renminbi bonds, right?
Yep.
Assuming to access a pool of domestic savings. And then it turns around and makes dollar loans, I would assume, to countries and companies such as in Venezuela, right? How does it deal with that mismatch? Because we're talking about huge amounts, right? So it's raising a bunch of raising money in renminbi and then turning around and making loans in dollars. Where does it get the dollars to do that? Does it go to the government?
Well, so most of its lending is domestic, right? Renminbi.
Okay, most of.
Most of it, about 75, more than 75%.
So maybe one-fourth is overseas.
Yeah.
So they're not making a loss on every loan. But, yeah, they do make a currency loss for dollar loans. But I think, as I said, if there's reports in Caixin that they do use the foreign exchange reserves. So if they can use those, then obviously that's hugely advantageous. They also do sell some bonds overseas.
My question was just the source of it. Like, what's the source of those dollars? Does it get it from the government? Because it's obviously got to make a dollar loan.
Yeah, we don't know. Okay. Some of it converted from renminbi, in which they make a loss. Some of it from overseas bonds, and maybe some from foreign exchange reserves in dollars. Yeah.
Back here, the woman in the white jacket.
Hi, my name is Xiao Mei. I'm from the World Resources Institute, China office, and thank you for the presentation. You pointed out that CDB played a very important role in China's urbanization process in the past. As you correctly pointed out that the Chinese local government in the past decades mainly relied on selling lands to raise revenue. That's a fact. Actually, 83% of China's local government's revenue coming from selling loans, selling lands. Mm. And of course, the remaining part mainly is channeled by CDB. So my question is, this China's very unique local government's very unique financing model is really decided by their limited financing and mechanisms they have, because the Chinese local governments are not allowed to issue local bonds, government bonds, not like in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Cities can raise their own bonds, and Chinese government, local governments are not allowed to. So the government's local mayors raise lots of issues with the central government. NDRC is currently piloting in 5 provinces, allow them to issue limited local government bonds. So moving forward, do you think there will impact China local government's financing model and impact CDB's impact, the roles in China's urbanization or just local infrastructure?
Yeah. You can do property tax. Yep. Bonds. So just on the bonds, yeah, they did do this trial where a few cities could issue bonds directly, but it was a complete disaster because the rate they sold the bonds at were below treasuries. So it actually was no one was looking at them at the risk of their own local government. So it didn't work, and I think that's why so far I don't think they've expanded that trial hugely. And I think if they can do that, then I think, yeah, CDB's role will get less if these local governments can raise money on their own, which is, I think, what they want. But in order for that to happen, you need a proper market. You need people to look at the local government itself, not just think, oh, they're going to be bailed out by central government. Mm-hmm. So you need to have some sense of risk and pricing.
Yeah, and I think what you really need to look at is a property tax, and it's something we've been looking at very closely as a way to wean the local governments away from their dependence on land sales. There's obviously been pilot projects as well with property tax in Chongqing and Shanghai, but they've been pilot projects for a couple of years now, and it hasn't expanded. There's a lot of talk about it. There's talk now, and there's state council, you know, mandates on starting to set up the national registry for homes, and so this is a very big pool of money that could be used as a revenue stream to go away from the dependence on land sales. It will be very interesting to see if that actually comes to pass and how it comes to pass, because it'll say so much about how this new government in China may be able to overcome some of the vested interests we always hear about. You know, there certainly are, you know, as China becomes a more complex country, you know, and with a lot more money at stake, there's a lot more interests at stake that may be opposing a policy, just like in, you know, like in any country. And so in China, one would think a real estate developer, property developer, or maybe an official with a lot of houses would not be too keen to have a national property registry and a property tax, because that would be, wouldn't be good for them. And so if the central government can overcome that, if the central government can overcome maybe opposition from local governments who like this system, or it'll say a lot, I think, about the strength and the commitment of the government to reforming the financial system. And I mean, maybe Nick knows a little bit more about what's going on. People I've talked to say that it's definitely, you know, there's definitely things, you know, happening on the property tax implementation nationwide. And why not? In 2010, I think HSBC estimated that residential property in China was worth, I think it was 109 trillion renminbi, so 18, 19 trillion U.S. dollars more. That's certainly got to be more than that now. So there's a huge base of value that you can tax that you know would bring in a big revenue stream for the government. I know that's not a little bit off topic, but it actually is on topic because you know CDB may have to change as well if its model domestically is to encourage you know local government financing, urbanization. If that focuses too much on infrastructure, that may not be in accord with what the government wants to do, encouraging more consumption. So the bank may have to evolve. The local governments may have to evolve.
Yeah, just add to that. So Li Keqiang talks about urbanization, but I think it's going to be a different sort of urbanization. I think he's talking more about building bigger towns rather than huge cities. So it's just a question of whether CDB's goal of urbanization is the same that what Li Keqiang is talking about. You know, whether the bank still has a role, I'm not sure. But.
Back here.
William Perez from the Inter-American Dialogues China Program. So the World Bank has MIGA and the U.S. has OPIC to underwrite certain types of political risk. China has Sinosure. Mm-hmm. What role, if any, does Sinosure has in terms of the China Development Bank's investments?
Yeah, it was interesting. We gave a talk in Shanghai and a lawyer who'd done a lot of these CDB deals came up and said, Sinosure was really key to the whole process, and we hadn't focused on it on enough. And I think they are taking a lot of risk, is what she said, in these deals. And you've got to question, you know, what's behind them, how much the central government's willing to take those losses. I think they did make losses on Libya, maybe some other places, but we didn't look at it that much.
We probably need to look at it a lot more. Yeah, I think it's a worthwhile project to look at Sinosure more.
Back there.
I'm Jason Chen from SAIS. I'm a visiting scholar to SAIS, I'm a PhD candidate from China. My question is about all these loans, actually commercial loans to Africa from CDB. And you mentioned a large part of these loans is benefit Chinese companies for the infrastructure projects in Africa. The question is, how do they make this happen? How could they make the Chinese companies get the projects? Is it written in the contracts between the government and the CDB, or the companies and CDB, or just because these Chinese infrastructure construction companies are more competitive than others? Thank you.
Well, I mean, if you ask CDB, I think they would say, you know, and the SOEs, they say, well, you know, we do these projects now better than anybody else. That's certainly what Chen Yuan's emissaries told us. You know, it's like, well, the French don't do this anymore, really. You know, we can do it at such a much better cost. Maybe the French should be more like IBM and just be the consultants, help us on environmental, you know, best practices and things, and we'll actually do all the work, you know, our SOE. So, you know, maybe even if they didn't have those stipulations, that Chinese companies would still be getting, you know, some of these projects. But certainly it is codified, you know, in regulations, agreements, you know, in Venezuela, Ghana, Brazil, you know, it's there. So there is.
Yeah, I'll just say these are very complicated contracts drawn up by foreign law firms, White and Case, these kind of firms. They do detail a lot of these contracts. Although, interestingly, one lawyer was telling me that in Venezuela, so as soon as you draw down the money, you have to start paying interest on it. And there was some concern that they couldn't find enough projects to use that money quickly enough. So that's kind of interesting whether they're all actually used on the desired projects.
Erica, I mean, you looked at this really carefully, too.
Yeah, I mean, just, I guess, to jump in here. In the case of Brazil, there was a $10 billion loan extended to the Brazilian national oil company, Petrobras, back in 2009, and $3 billion of that was earmarked for buying oil services and equipment from China. My understanding is that has not been touched, but nonetheless, when I was researching this, one of my many Google searches turned up a document. I forget who issued it in China, but basically saying it was basically a document aimed at oil services companies saying that CDB made this $10 billion loan to Petrobras. $3 billion is earmarked for oil service companies. If you want to come bid, or if you want to come find out more about, you know, what you might be able to do in Brazil, you know, and then they had a date and a location. And then as Henry and Mike mentioned, in the case of the $20 billion dual currency loan to Venezuela, that's codified. You can find it. There's a publication called the Official Gazette, and it says that the projects are going to be decided sort of jointly by CDB in Venezuela, sort of on a project-by-project basis, and there's a certain amount of the money has to be spent on buying and hiring from China. Yeah. Although how you go from that to sort of specific companies coming in, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I think that's the crucial point. Is it's very easy in a contract to specify a project, but actually carrying that out is much more difficult. And I was just looking at news this morning of one of the Venezuelan railway projects is not getting its money paid back or is running into some difficulties. So I think actually carrying out the project is more difficult than just writing it in the contract.
Up here.
Thanks. Great presentation. I had a question about the oil for money or the commodities for money deals and how they're structured. Are these left open to the extent that you'll pay us back with resources based on the price at that time of those resources to what, you know, the equivalent of what you borrowed? Or are they pegging a price for that resource? Are they speculating on the resource in some sort of way? And might that factor into the question that the gentleman over there raised, which is it from that speculation that they derive some greater sense of security on the loans that they're making?
So I think, according to the lawyers, it's at market prices, but they use a sort of average market price to forecast what the price would be over the life of the loan. But it's not a set price throughout the entire agreement of the loan, right?
Right. That's what you found, too.
The one difference would be the first two $4 billion loans from CDB to the China-Venezuela Joint Investment Fund, those had fixed prices. The first one was X number of barrels at 100 barrels per day, and then the other one had I think that had a fluctuating, there's a price band, and then I think the subsequent ones have our market prices. And Petrobras was very clear that they were that they were selling at a market price. And I think in Turkmenistan, where it's gas, it's too opaque to know.
Mm-hmm. And Ghana, same thing. I remember the press conference was something he kept stressing was, oh, it's not like they're getting our oil for cheap, you know, something he kept saying.
Okay, one more question. In the back.
Hi, Chris Phelan with Rio Tinto. My question is regard to the China-Africa Development Fund and some of the issues that you mentioned they had run into infrastructurally in Africa. I was curious if you see CDB or the CADF changing their risk premia calculations within the continent of Africa in regards to infrastructure loans and development in any of those contexts.
I don't know if it's changed. I don't know recently. I haven't looked at him, you know, recently whether it's changing. You would probably know more than us, considering, you know, the cooperation between CADF and Rio Tinto. I don't know.
I don't get any sense it's changing, although we haven't interviewed them recently. But I know, Xi Jinping went on his recent trip and there was a whole pledge of money for more deals. So I don't think they're sort of changing their focus, at least not that I've seen. Ethiopia, the glass factory, it was shut while I was there, but they did say that they were going to restart it and get the project going again. So I don't see any sign that they're, like, changing necessarily. Yeah.
Right, but as far as if there's been a recent change in their way they look at risks and price risks, I honestly just don't know. I don't know. But it's, maybe we can ask, try to get some information on it. Yeah. But you might know, Jeff.
Talks of January. Mm-hmm. They're doing 8 projects in South Africa, mm-hmm. and they have a big chunk there. And so that suggests to me that that's more than 10% of projects, anyway, are mm-hmm. going into that one country, which is riskier now, but it's still pretty stable.
Yeah.
So that's, and that's more there than any other country in Africa. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to draw our discussion to a close because this room is booked at 4:00. Thank you again, Mike and Henry, and thank you everyone for coming. Mm-hmm.